It's a privilege to be here today, especially passing on to you the teachings of my great teacher, Suzuki Roshi, and by passing on his teachings, passing on the teachings of all the great Buddhist ancestors, all the way back to Shakyamuni Buddha. Hashimoto Roshi, a famous Zen master, points out that when the Japanese cook, they prepare each ingredient separately. So rice is here, pickles are there, but inside your stomach, everything gets mixed up. This is the world of the absolute, Roshi says, our Roshi. As long as the rice and the pickles and soup remain separate, they're not working. This is like your intellectual understanding or book knowledge. It remains separate from your actual life. Zazen practice is mixing up the various ways we have of understanding and letting it all work together. A kerosene lamp, Roshi says, will not work merely because it's filled with kerosene. It also needs air for combustion. And even with air, it needs matches. So by the aid of matches and air and kerosene, the lamp will work. And this is our Zazen practice. This is exactly our Zazen practice. So Roshi says, in the same way, even though you say, I have Buddha nature, that alone is not enough to make it work. If you do not have a friend or a sangha, it won't work. When we practice with the aid of a sangha, helped by Buddha, we can practice Zazen in its true sense. Roshi says, we will have bright light here in the Tassajara Zendo or in our daily life. Thich Nhat Hanh once said to students after a long, intense retreat, they were just very involved and worked very hard, and he said, if when you go home, you do not find others to practice with, I guarantee you, he says, I guarantee you that everything you've learned will fall away. Just think of that. He told all of these retreat students that, everything they learned would fall away if they didn't find others to practice with. But it's much easier. I just want to say it's much easier today because of the pandemic, that there are all of these periods of Zazen that are online that you can tune into. Anyway, Roshi says that to have a so-called enlightenment experience is, of course, important, but what is more important is to know how to adjust the flame in Zazen and in our everyday life. He's referring to his kerosene lamp metaphor. When the flame is in complete combustion, you don't smell the oil. When your life is in complete combustion, you have no complaint and there is no need for you to be aware of your practice. When your life is in complete combustion, you have no complaint and there is no need for you to be aware of your practice. If we talk too much about Zazen, it is already smoky kerosene lamp practice. He means we should just do it. There's no need to talk about it. Roshi says, maybe I'm a smoky kerosene lamp. I don't necessarily want to give a lecture. I just want to live with you, moving stones, having a nice hot spring bath, and eating something good. Zen is right here. When I start to talk, it is already a smoky kerosene lamp. As long as I must give a lecture, I have to explain, this is right practice, this is wrong practice, this is how to practice Zazen. It's like giving you a recipe. It doesn't work. You can't eat a recipe. Dogen Zenji's teaching also is to live in each moment in complete combustion, like a lamp or a candle. To live each moment, becoming one with everything, is the point of his teaching and his practice. So I'm going to give you an example, again from Tolstoy, of Dogen's teaching of living each moment in complete combustion. And you'll probably not be surprised, it features Natasha. And Natasha, by the way, is Tolstoy. If you ever want to know what Tolstoy thinks, look for what Natasha says about it, and then you'll know exactly what he thinks. Even though she was only 13 when we met her in the book, her spirit is Tolstoy. So in this scene, Natasha and her brother Nikolai are invited by their uncle, and as Natasha calls him, to his cabin in the woods at the end of a day of hunting. His housekeeper, Anisha, a serf from his estate, she's sort of his unofficial wife, brings in a tray loaded with homemade Russian specialties. And after enjoying that, they hear strains of a balalaika in the servants' room. So it's not the sort of music that a countess, Natasha, should have liked. But seeing Natasha so moved by it, Uncle calls for his guitar and he quickly accelerates this to the rhythm of a Russian dance. And then Uncle sings and then he stops short and he jerks his shoulders. And so this is the passage from Tolstoy. "Go on, Uncle dear," Natasha wailed in an imploring tone, as if her life depended on it. Uncle rose, and it was as if there were two men in him. One of them smiled seriously at the merry fellow, while the merry fellow struck a naive and precise attitude, preparatory of a folk dance. "Now then, niece," he exclaimed, waving to Natasha the hand that had just struck a chord. Natasha threw off the shawl from her shoulders, ran forward to face Uncle, and setting her arms akimbo, also made a motion with her shoulders and struck an attitude. Where, how, and when had this young countess, educated by an emigre French governess, imbibed from the Russian air she breathed that spirit and obtained that manner, which the, excuse me, I can't pronounce it, Padishah would, one would have supposed, long ago have effaced. But the spirit and the movements were those inimitable and unteachable Russian ones that Uncle had expected of her. As soon as she had struck her pose and smiled triumphantly, proudly, and with sly merriment, the fear that had at first seized Nikolai and the others that she might not do the right thing was at an end, and they were all already admiring her. She did the right thing with such precision, such complete precision, that Anisya Fyodorovna, it's probably not how to pronounce it, who had at once handed her the handkerchief she needed for the dance, had tears in her eyes, though she laughed as she watched this slim, graceful countess reared in silks and velvets and so different from herself, who yet was able to understand all that was in Anisya and in Anisya's father and mother and aunt and in every Russian man and woman. This is called I Don't Know Zazen. We don't know what Zazen is anymore. I don't know who I am. To find complete composure when you don't know who you are and where you are, that is to accept things as it is, as Roshi says. I'm going to read that again. This is called I Don't Know Zazen. We don't know what Zazen is anymore. I don't know who I am. To find complete composure when you don't know who you are and where you are, that is to accept things as it is. Roshi says, even though you don't know who you are, you accept yourself. That is you in its true sense. When you know who you are, that you will not be the real you. You may overestimate yourself quite easily, but when you say, oh, I don't know, then you are you and you know yourself completely, and that is enlightenment. So this is very counterintuitive. When you know who you are, so to speak, Roshi's saying, this is not the real you. And when you're just kind of not even thinking about who you are, that's the real you. So I want to say something about when we know who we, when we are, when we think we know who we are, that's small self consciousness. So there's self consciousness. This is small self consciousness. And when we have no idea, we're not even thinking about who we are. We're just being. There's big self consciousness. So I think for me, making that distinction between small self consciousness and big self consciousness, because our big self actually can't be known with our regular mind, our small self mind. That's why when we don't know who we are, that's our real self. I hope that's clear. This is kind of the way I'm understanding what Roshi is saying. And I think thinking about it as the difference between small self and big self and each of their consciousnesses makes it clear that when what we know with our small self consciousness. And so we can't know our big self. We can just be it. So Roshi goes on and says, I think our teaching is very, very good. But if we become arrogant and believe in ourselves too much, we will be lost. There will be no teaching, no Buddhism at all. When we find the joy in our life, in our composure, we don't know what it is. We don't understand anything. Then our mind is very great, very wide. Our mind is open to everything. So it is big enough to know before we know something. We are grateful even before we have something. Even before we attain enlightenment, we are happy to practice our way. Otherwise, we cannot attain anything in its true sense. I'm gonna read that one again too, because it's so important. Roshi says, I think our teaching is very, very good, but if we become arrogant and believe in ourselves too much, we will be lost. There will be no teaching, no Buddhism at all. Yet you have to understand, he left Japan, which was full of people practicing Zazen, but they were stuck in their ways. It was stale. And it was so stale, they couldn't see that it was stale. And Roshi left, and he delights, when he was alive, he delighted in people who didn't know anything about Zen, so that they were open to actually being available to being taught. I stopped in the middle of what I was saying. But he says, when we find the joy of our life in composure, we don't know what it is, we don't understand anything, and our mind is very great and wide. Our mind is open to everything, so it is big enough to know before we know something. We are grateful even before we have something. Even before we attain enlightenment, we are happy to practice our way. Otherwise, we cannot attain anything in its true sense. And that relates to the gaining mind that we talked about, I think, last week. If there's a gaining mind, there's no attaining anything. So you might ask what the difference, you're looking at, let's say, Natasha that I just presented, and what's the difference in just being spontaneous and finding complete composure when you don't know who you are or where you are? And I want to point out that it's the difference between Nikolai, who was worried that she wasn't doing the right thing, and Natasha, who was just being. That's the difference. It's really clear. in Tolstoy. In that example, it's really clear what the difference is. So he was being spontaneous and just, yeah, let's go to uncle's house. Great. But then, you know, is Natasha doing the right thing when she strikes her pose and jumps up and starts dancing? So supporting the former, that is being spontaneous, there's a sweetness and freshness of living in the moment, but it can be a kind of character trait. It can be, you know, I'm just a spontaneous person, but there's no real consciousness behind it. And I don't know mind arising from the hard work of Zazen while being entirely conscious of itself allows for everything and enters fully into everything and knows before knowing because of its openness. The spontaneous person actually can be closed. It's like two plants that look, they resemble one another, but they're actually from two different families. Or two are like two kinds of awareness, a small self awareness or a big self awareness. The former, with the former, there's smoke, and with the latter, it just burns clean. So here are the three most important points from today. When you know who you are, that you will not be the real you. When you're, oh, I don't know, then you are you and you know yourself completely. That's I don't know Zazen. When we find the joy of our life in our composure, we don't know what it is, we don't understand anything, then our mind is very great and very wide. Our mind is open to everything, so it is big enough to know before we know something. We are grateful even before we have something. That's the second important point from today. And this is how you feel after like a long period of Zazen, or like especially during Sesshin, when you get up from a long day of Zazen, of sitting, you feel extremely grateful just to move or see a beautiful tree or hear an owl. And the third point from today is when your life is in complete combustion, you have no complaint and there is no need to be aware of your practice. Remember Pierre, by the way. So you might say, what's this no complaint thing? Remember Pierre, who was a prisoner of war and made to march all day long. And if he lagged behind, he'd be shot. And he was eating rye flour soup and horse flesh. and he was ecstatic. That's being extremely grateful and having no complaints. With this, I don't know mind. So when your life is in complete combustion, you have no complaint and there is no need to be aware of your practice. So that's the third important point from today. And here are six things for you to think about during the week, and maybe write about in your notebook, if you have one. What to you is complete combustion? Is there something in your life that you do with complete combustion? That's the second one. What is the relationship between not knowing and complete combustion? It's really worth sitting with that and really getting how the two are so closely related. And then the fourth one, what does incomplete combustion feel like? And the fifth one is to describe yourself in your composure. Who are you in your composure? And then this idea, our mind is open to everything. So it is big enough to know before we know something and grateful even before we have something. To just comment on this any way you can. Just think about it and just have a response to it in some way. As if you were writing a paper. I don't know if I should repeat those or not. I'll just quickly. What to you is complete combustion? Is there something in your life that you do with complete combustion? The relationship between not knowing and complete combustion? What's incomplete combustion? Describe yourself in your composure. And to comment on this idea of knowing before you know and being grateful before you have. So I have some questions already. That turning to questions now, that have been asked, and I think I'll start with those without Sahar today. I'm going to start with those, and maybe other questions will come in. So someone asked. Natasha seems like she has everything. She's a countess, she's slim and educated and musical, so no wonder she can just be her natural self. But I'm not like that. It's hard for me to even picture being that spontaneous, like Natasha in this description. You know, Natasha being Tolstoy comes from a life of great spirituality and contemplation, intense political and social justice consciousness, and consciousness of himself as a man and as a father, as a grandfather, all of which he was very good at. And he had to recover from his own huge set of problems. So through Natasha, he portrays the awareness that's non-awareness and finds composure in not knowing who she is or where she is. And this is available to you also through Zazen practice. It's like another kind of school that our culture just doesn't talk about. Just think of this whole, everything we're doing here actually, as a kind of school that our culture doesn't talk about. Another question is about if you don't have a friend or a sangha, it won't work. That idea. This person says, I'm an introvert. The things that last with me are things like reading and writing that I can do alone. The idea of a sangha doesn't appeal to me. Though with Zazen practice, I can see Roshi's point. And can you comment on this? And I think it's the combustion principle. You know, there just has to be matches. You have to have matches too. The others, having others will ignite your practice. And until your sitting is really just completely in your bones, you'll end up either finding reasons not to do it or your sitting will be weak. It's very hard to get started all by yourself. So, but nowadays, you know, nowadays it's really easy online. And as I said before, it's kind of not a problem today. And you can still be alone. You can be alone and with others. There's one, can you say a little bit more about the connection between a smoky kerosene lamp and when you know who you are, that you is not the real you. So the question is the connection between a smoky kerosene lamp and when you know who you are, that you will not be the real you. So big self-awareness looks like it's nothing. You can't go, oh, that person is practicing big self, you know, it looks like nothing. It looks like the person is just being a person and you don't even notice. The person just goes through the day doing her things, doing whatever with ease and composure and comfortableness in her engagement with her life, as if there's no separation between her movements and her life. There's no her there, really, but her movements are pure and strong. They're not smoky. So what Roshi is really saying is there's kind of a smokiness around knowing who you are, because no matter what we do, there's a sense of I'm doing it. This is very subtle, but actually practicing Zazen, it isn't even subtle. You just know, you just get it. You know exactly what I'm talking about now, and of course what Roshi was talking about. So there's this other one. How do you know when you have an I don't know mind? And I think you actually don't know. you sense it. You sense not an it. You just sense being in the world in a way that just carries on under all circumstances. It just carries on with composure and with comfortableness and with ease. Maybe after a period of being that way, you can recognize yourself as having been that way. So maybe you can detect an I don't know mind when you get back into your I do know mind. Are there other questions that have come in?
There's one question. I try to practice Zazen and think about the bigger self throughout the day. Sometimes I wake up in the middle of the night and everything seems empty, the whole thought of it. Is this a moment of not knowing that I should be thankful for, even though it's unpleasant? Or is this just smoke? Smoky lamp.
That's a good question. You know, you would be in a better position to answer the question than me. Since I don't know you and the experience you've had with practicing something that will give you access to your big mind, to just who big self you is, then that would be how you know, of having previous experiences of big self, kind of like I was saying in a session after a long period of sitting. There's a sense when you get up of not knowing anything, and I can imagine it being similar to waking up in the middle of the night. Disoriented, but I'm not sure that disoriented is the same thing as big mind. That's why I almost can't answer the question, but that's what the answer lies there. Is your disoriented the same as how you feel during and after long periods of sitting? That's the best I can answer you.
Thank you. There's not another question right now. I had a side question. I mean, it's kind of a side question, but you've mentioned before Roshi moving rocks around. And what was he doing exactly with these rocks?
I didn't know whether to explain at the time. So Roshi had this passion, really, literally passion for taking not rocks, boulders from the Tassajara stream. There's a stream flowing right when they've moved the Zendo now up to where the garden used to be. But when I was at Tassajara, there was a Tassajara stream ran right by the Zendo. And so all during Zazen, you can just listen to this gurgle. It was like amazing and wonderful. And in the stream were boulders. And actually in the beginning, my cabin was, I set myself on the back porch of a cabin. And so I was like right over this, I was, you know, a few feet from the stream above, also listening to this continual gurgling. It was absolutely marvelous. But so in the stream are boulders, and Roshi and his assistant would, during work period, move boulders from Tassajara Creek to a rock garden that he was making outside of his cabin. And one of his assistants tells the story of, you know, this is a big guy, and he was Roshi's assistant at that time, and the two of them were having an especially hard time moving this one boulder, and the assistant was exhausted. And so Roshi says, "That's all right, I'll do it by myself. You go rest." And the assistant made the assistant go rest. And later, when the assistant came back, the boulder was in Roshi's garden. So he moved it all by himself, like this, I don't know how many tons of a boulder. So I don't know. That's what he wanted to do, and he loved doing it. And even now, so Kwan Roshi, Jakusho, tells about going back to Tassajara. I remember Kwan Roshi when he was Shuso at a practice period, when everybody had to go up and ask him a question and he had to answer. And then that made him into a priest. And then now he's a very long-term and established Roshi. But anyway, he went back to Tassajara with a whole team of his students and moved one of the boulders that was in Roshi's garden to his monastery, just as a way of honoring the part of Roshi's ashes that are at his monastery. That's all I know about it. I hope that answers your question, but it is a kind of wonderful part of Roshi, and it's so mysterious. I mean, how in the world he was a very small person, and how he moved this boulder that his huge assistant in conjunction with him couldn't move. He moved it all by himself. And who knows how that happened. So, but he was enlightened. So maybe that's how.
That's great. Thank you. We have another question here. They write, "I strive for self-awareness, self-confidence, self-knowledge. These seem like things that help me operate in the world in a cleaner way, but they sound smoky in Roshi's analogy. Are they too focused on the small self?"
No, that's how we have to get to our big self. We get to big self through small self. But if your small self is, you know, in a saloon all day or, you know, whatever, completely unaware that there is such a thing even as a big self. I mean, here you are listening to a talk like this and being as self-aware as you can be and practicing practices that are designed to enhance that. All of these things are like, you know, the best you can do right now. And it's wonderful. It's wonderful, but it is still a smoky kerosene lamp. I'm sorry to say, you know, I'm a smoky kerosene lamp too. And Roshi says, you know, maybe I'm a kerosene lamp because I don't even want to give these lectures. So he's complaining, you know. Now Pierre didn't even complain. Pierre, I'm not saying, I'm just joking here, but Pierre was definitely had his, you know, moment of enlightenment. So my answer is we all have to go through this, but this is the way. Way with a capital W.
Thank you. Another person, or maybe the same person, I'm not sure, wrote in related to the last question. I think that people have experiences often early in life that distort or interfere with their ability to see themselves clearly. I am thinking of things like trauma, neglect, etc. Do you think our small self must be shored up to some extent before understanding of large self is possible?
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. So I'm an example of that. And first of all, when you have a traumatic mind, it's very hard to grasp things. And so I don't know, I must have had really good karma that I kind of landed at Zen Center. I don't even know quite how that happened. It happened through an especially strong period of suffering, that's for sure. So then landing at Zen Center and with this traumatic mind, everything came in through my body. I think I've told this story before. And all the understanding didn't come with my head. I didn't get it that way. It's still small self consciousness, but it's, I'm just trying to say that you can get it in, you can get it in different ways. And if you've had a traumatic childhood, and you're not functioning with your full self, these teachings, the essence of these teachings, and these are enlightenment teachings, can come in not through the way that someone without a traumatized nervous system gets them. So it's all good. You can get these teachings anyway. That's the upshot. It's all good. And it's very hard for a traumatized mind or a traumatized body. But you get them anyway. That's my answer.
Just a question on big self. Is it correct that big self is the universal everything that we all are? Is that is what big self is?
Yes, that is what big self is. But we get big self, you can call, what I always call it is with wisdom mind. And wisdom mind is not attainable. It's not, we don't have access to that except through practices like Zazen. We can't think our way into wisdom mind. We have to just get wisdom mind. We can't think our way there. So that's why it's so mysterious.
Thank you. That was the last question for now. I don't know if you want to wait a little or what you would like to do.
Well, one thing I would like to do is say a word about the next series. So next week will be our last, the 10th talk in this series. And next, then we'll take a 1 week break. So March 28th, we will not have a Dharma talk. But then right away in April, April 4th, the first Sunday in April, we'll begin a 12-week series based on a series of lectures that Suzuki Roshi gave on a poem called The Sandokai at Tassajara in 1970. And I was there. I was there for these lectures. And so they're very special to me. The Sandokai was originally a Taoist poem. And Roshi took this poem and based his lecture series on them. And he says, when it's a Taoist poem, it's a Taoist poem. And when it's a Buddhist poem, it's a Buddhist poem. And he set up a little board beside his lectern, and he translated the poem word for word. And they're collected, these lectures are collected in a book called Branching Streams Flow in the Darkness. And so that will be the title of this 12 series of talks that I'll be starting in the first week in April will be From Branching Streams Flow in the Darkness, that series of lectures. So I wanted to be sure to announce that. And as always, you can go to the website and register. You can register for all 12 at the same time. And I don't know that everybody knows that starting from the second series, all of these talks are available by podcast. So I just wanted to say, not the first series, but the second and the third will be available by podcast.
Thank you. That sounds great. And someone commented very exciting. And I think so too. And just to note that it should be up on the website later this week, not right now actually, but probably by midweek you should be able to register on the website for that. So there's no more questions right now.
I think we'll just end for today. And thank you for coming. I'm so happy to share these teachings. And we'll continue next week. Thank you.